supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Montgomery County State Senator Daylon Leach is resisting calls to resign in the wake of accusations of sexual misconduct. He says he wants to work with Pennsylvania Senate leaders to address the allegations. WHYY's Dave Davies reports that lawmakers in Harrisburg aren't sure just what that means.
A story in the Philadelphia Inquirer says several women reported offensive comments or unwelcome touching by Leach over the past several years. Under the Senate policy on workplace harassment, employees file complaints that are investigated by the Senate secretary and chief clerk. Employment lawyer Alice Ballard says that's not a great tool to vet the Leach charges because, for one thing, it applies to state employees.
The kinds of people who are talking about Senator Leach are not employees. They're people who've worked on his campaigns, volunteers, that sort of thing. So I don't think the Senate policy would apply.
Ballard says campaign volunteers have no legal recourse unless there's a sexual assault that would merit a criminal complaint. So what happens to the Leach allegations? It's not clear. The Ethics Committee could investigate if it gets a complaint and recommend sanctions to the Senate. Duquesne law professor Bruce Ledowitz says the state constitution permits a two-thirds vote to expel a senator for certain offenses, including, quote, disorderly behavior in its presence.
Disorderly behavior in its presence could, in fact, be interpreted to include the treatment of staff.
While Governor Tom Wolf has called for Leach's resignation, few lawmakers have. One exception is Delaware County State Representative Leanne Krueger-Branicki.
This problem is not new. It goes back a long time, and there is a pervasive culture in Harrisburg that has covered these things up. It is part of the good old boys network that we face right now.
Krueger-Branicki has introduced a bill to overhaul the legislature's sexual harassment policies. Tuesday afternoon, the Senate Democratic Caucus updated its policy to provide more protection for future victims and ban taxpayer payouts for misconduct. But that won't answer the question of how the Senate will deal with the accusations against Leach. Dave Davies, WHYY News.
As a part of President Donald Trump's crackdown on immigrants in the country illegally, federal immigration officers are increasingly making arrests at courthouses, including those in Philadelphia. Federal immigration authorities say courthouse security ensures that those arrests happen without incident. But legal experts are concerned that using Philadelphia's courtrooms as bait to enforce immigration laws is scaring people from coming to court. WHYY's Bobby Allen reports.
Tetti Addy is a 53-year-old from Liberia who's lived in the U.S. for nearly two decades without ever committing a crime. In October, Addy was on his way to Philadelphia Family Court over a divorce issue involving his ex-wife. The court is in a tall glass building in Center City, Philadelphia. To get in, you have to wait in a line in the lobby to pass through the metal detectors. Addy never made it to the hearing. When he walked in and headed towards security, a guy wearing an unmarked winter cap and a jacket approached him.
After I told him, I'm Tetti Addy, that's when he said, I'm looking for you. You overstay your visa and you should be out of this country.
His visa had lapsed, though he was working on fixing that. Talking with the stranger was making him late to his hearing, and he was starting to raise his voice. Then another guy arrived, shorter than the first.
And started to tackle me, you know, get me from the line or from the checkpoint to take me outside. And I was a little bit hesitant because I don't know who he was. And then when we got outside, then the shorter guy, he said, I'm ICE.
He was put inside an SUV with tinted windows and was taken to ICE's Philadelphia field office to be processed. On the way there, Addy kept saying, I'm not a criminal.
The other guy said, you are a criminal. I said, this is crazy. That's what I said. I said, this is crazy.
From there, ICE brought him to an immigration prison in York County. After about a week in detention, he found himself in front of immigration judge Kumas Goldpavar.
So can you just state your full name for the record? I probably mispronounced it a little bit.
Tetti Augustine Addy, Your Honor.
Thank you.
The judge says Addy's two kids, 18 months and 25, are legal residents, and so is his elderly mother, who can sponsor him for a permanent legal status. After a 12-minute hearing, Goldpavar made a decision.
I do find that he is somewhat of a minimal flight risk, and I'm going to set bond in the amount of $5,000.
Addy posted 10% of that, and he was released. His lawyer, Mike Henry, is confident the whole thing will be behind Addy soon, once his paperwork is approved. More and more, Henry says, immigrants going to court for things like traffic violations and domestic disputes are being nabbed by ICE.
The people that were detained in the past were people that were already convicted of fairly serious and deportable offenses. The enforcement priorities have changed all that, kind of stood it on its head.
By enforcement priorities, he's talking about Trump's push to have not just those in the country illegally who are criminals deported, but to also chase people like Addy, who have expired visas. And to carry out this mission in Philadelphia, ICE agents are keeping an eye on court dockets to intercept immigrants on their way to hearings.
The uptick of ICE's presence has really created a chilling effect on the way we go about trying our cases and even defending them.
Keir Bradford Gray is the city's top public defender.
I mean, it impacts not only, of course, the defendants, but it impacts people who are witnesses, potential witnesses in their case. They're really afraid to come forward. They're really afraid to go in support of their family member or loved one.
But why courthouses? Why not pick them up some other place? Department of Homeland Security officials have defended the practice by saying since courts are secure places, it's the safest way to make an arrest. Cesar Garcia Hernandez is an immigration law expert at the University of Denver. He says the Department of Homeland Security's disapproval of Philly's sanctuary city status might have something to do with it, too.
There is substantial symbolic value targeting migrants in courthouses because those locations go to the heart of democratic governance. And in many locations where ICE has targeted courthouses specifically, the Department of Homeland Security takes issue with the policies of democratically elected officials.
Top officials with Philadelphia's court system say there's nothing they can do to prevent it from happening, which is troubling to Garcia Hernandez. He says courts depend on all parties showing up. And so ICE arrests could undermine local judicial systems from doing their job.
And most perniciously, this is witness intimidation that is happening by government agents.
Even though top court officials in Philly say they can't go against the federal government, some practicing criminal law in New York have gotten creative. For instance, defense attorneys have hid immigrant clients in courtroom bathrooms, and judges have set high bail so an immigrant would be temporarily jailed to dodge an ICE officer waiting in the wings.
All efforts to push back on this kind of activity will send a clear message to the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency that state and local officials take seriously the sanctity of the courthouses in their communities.
ICE officials refuse to reveal exactly how many arrests agents have made at Philly courthouses. But an ICE spokesman says they do not discourage arrests at the courthouse the same way they do at churches, schools, and hospitals. Critics argue that courthouses should be added to the list of so-called sensitive locations. In the district that includes Philadelphia, figures show that ICE arrests in all locations have shot up more than 30% from last year. Ted DiAtti's courthouse arrest was part of that spike. The complaint from his ex-wife that sent him to court in the first place has been thrown out. And though he's hopeful his immigration troubles will soon be over too, the whole thing has cost him thousands of dollars, required multiple hearings, and left him detained for a week, after which he said he lost his steady construction job. What would have happened if he was deported back to Liberia?
I would go crazy. Because I'm not used to the way of life over there anymore.
Even though his legal status is not on solid ground right now, he says it doesn't change his core identity.
I am an American because I've been here 19 years. I love this country. I love the people. So I think I should be given the chance to live here.
Addy hopes that fewer immigrants who show up to court trying to follow the law are arrested there for breaking it. Bobby Allen, WHYY News.
Philadelphia is trying to collect decades of back taxes by auctioning off thousands of properties with delinquent tax bills to the highest bidder. These sheriff sales are attracting investors looking to capitalize on the city's red-hot real estate market. Critics warn the city is turning these properties over to speculators while putting stress on low-income homeowners. Joining us to discuss his recent reporting on the issue is Ryan Briggs for WHYY's Plan Philly. Ryan, welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with a refresher. How do these sheriff sales work, and then who's purchasing the properties?
Most of the properties that we looked at were tax lien sales, so that's homeowners who owe the city some amount of tax debt, and the city, through a legal process, will petition to have those properties sent to essentially a public auction.
And is it mostly regulars participating, or is it new citizens each time?
You'll usually have people who are sort of like professional sheriff sale purchasers. You'll have people who are representing maybe foreign investors who will show up. You will have a lot of other people who are sort of playing the lottery and maybe want to get in on some of this, cut rate land that the city is putting up. But for the most part, the vast majority of the sales wind up going to the pros.
Among the professionals, the person who says he has purchased the most properties over the past few years is one Adam Ehrlich. Tell us about him.
He is a former options trader who took a turn into the world of professional gambling and was on an NBC show called Face the Ace, betting on Texas Hold'em for something like $1 million pot.
Adam is down to just three outs if he hopes to keep a shot at 200 grand alive.
You know,
is an ace coming? Is it coming?
If the ace was ever to come, this would be the time.
Okay, let's see the river. Hey!
The river's a five. Adam's pair is not big enough.
Sorry,
it's the
Adam.
End of the road.
Got beat by one of the best. What can you do?
Now he has turned to another speculative world, which is Philadelphia real estate, Philadelphia sheriff sales, and he's accumulated something like 500 properties in just 3 years of buying. He says, well, I'm taking this distressed real estate and then I'm putting it up for resale. So he says that's the value that he adds. Other people look and they say, well, you're buying this land, it's extremely distressed, and then you're sitting on it. And to some people, that's the definition of a speculator.
So the sheriff sale process is the same. It's the real estate market that is hot now, and that's what's driving this new type of player.
I would say it's two things. One is the increasing interest in the Philadelphia real estate market. And then I would also say that the city is sending more properties to sheriff sale.
It's certainly drawn the interest of one city council president, Darrell Clark. What's his analysis?
Council President Clark looks at the increased number of properties that the city is sending to sheriff sale, or at least threatening to send to sheriff sale, and is concerned that that presents a risk to homeowners. Some of the properties that are petitioned for a tax lien sale are occupied, and there are homeowners who live in those homes and maybe owe small amounts of back tax. And they can be threatened with a sheriff sale if they don't pay. And we chronicled one individual, a man named James Murphy, who owed the city about $1,000. And they threatened to send his property to sheriff sale.
We're trying to live a decent life, be respectable in our community, and not actually, be productive citizens in our society. But it doesn't work out like that. And it's really unfair because all we're trying to do is survive. And we're a paycheck away of us being in the shelter.
Legal advocates will say you just shouldn't be sending anyone. You shouldn't even be threatening anyone with sheriff sale over such a minuscule amount of back tax when there are investors or other entities that owe tens of thousands of dollars and maybe have been delinquent for, 10 or 20 years.
Is that an indictment, though, on the investor, or in this case, Ehrlich, or is it more the sheriff sale system?
I mean, Ehrlich makes it very clear that, he doesn't bid on occupied property. So I think there's sort of two things that are happening here. The city is attempting to send a lot more property to sheriff sale, and investors are responding to that. But as the city casts that net, sometimes they catch homeowners who probably are not the best example of a tax cheat or a scofflaw or something like that. And so you're kind of adding stress. Mr. Murphy's property, it never actually made it to auction. No one ever bid on it. So from the city's perspective, that was a resolution.
Thanks, Ryan.
Thanks for having me.
Ryan Briggs for WHYY's Plan Philly. This spring, the mayor's Special Opioid Task Force released its final report, outlining recommendations to reduce the harms caused by abuse of the drugs. In response, the city recently created a new position, a harm reduction coordinator. WHYY's Alana Gordon, who's been covering the region's opioid drug crisis, sat down with Allison Herrens, who's taking on the new role.
Allison, thank you for joining Newsworks tonight.
Thank you for having me.
What drew you to this position?
I grew up in the area, so my life personally has been impacted by the opiate crisis quite a bit between family members, partners, friends. Currently is still fairly impacted by it. So I decided to get my master's in social work, originally from more of a criminal justice reform background. But I obviously there's a ton of overlap between criminal justice and drug addiction because it is often criminalized here in the United States. When I originally went into social work, I wanted to work in direct service initially to be able to just inform larger policy. And it's my big belief that if you don't work with the populations that you're trying to create programs and policies for, you're not really informed about the populations and what they really need.
I just can't shake this number, 1,200, which is what I've heard from the health department about the projection of how many people are expected to die this past year from overdose deaths. Mm-hmm. And it seems like something that's surpassed the AIDS epidemic in its peak. And so I wonder, stepping into this new position, how you see the city getting a handle on this.
You know, I think the city has done a good job of coming together to try to create a system-wide approach to how we treat this. I think a lot of really great recommendations came out of the task force in terms of addressing this issue in an overall sense, so that we're not just thinking about overdose prevention or just education. You know, we're really trying to hit the issue from all angles, whether it's the doctor's prescribing or naloxone access or education. You know, we're really trying to decrease the numbers really any way we can.
As a harm reduction coordinator, what are you actually tasked with doing?
It's essentially my job to handle a lot of our naloxone initiatives around distribution to community partners, including Department of Prisons, SEPTA Police, Prevention Point, other community organizations, and then also expand naloxone trainings. But then other responsibilities just include expanding other harm reduction initiatives. You know, overall, you know, we're really just trying to help keep people safe until they can get to that stage where they're ready for recovery. It really requires a lot of education, not just for the users, but, you know, the people they surround themselves with, not just about naloxone, but, you know, how to use safely, you know, how to take other harm reduction strategies, such as not using alone, just ways to keep people safe. Mm-hmm. Until they're ready for treatment, because obviously we do want people to get into treatment and get to a stage of recovery, but that's not something you can force on people. It doesn't work.
I'm really struck because harm reduction coordinator is kind of an unusual title for a public job. Harm reduction itself as a philosophy and public health approach has been really mired in politics, especially in the U.S., mm-hmm. because as I understand harm reduction, it essentially aims to reduce the risks associated with drug use,
right.
instead of like focusing on stopping it completely or right. like a just say no approach.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering what it means for you and for the city to now have an actual harm reduction coordinator, if that signifies some sort of shift.
I think it signifies that as a city that we are finally starting to at least address the fact that you can't force people into treatment. We can have this moral code, but, you know, people still have their own choices in life. And part of helping people is really respecting those choices and acknowledging those choices. We need to meet people where they're at if we really want to have a widespread impact on this issue. It's not even just about fatal overdose. You know, there's a million other factors that go into this. You know, spread of infectious diseases, you know, HIV, Hep C. There's a lot to tackle with this issue.
When you talk about people being safe, one of the things within harm reduction that gets talked about a lot is safe right now, especially is safe injection sites.
Yeah.
It's controversial here. The DEA strongly opposes it. And basically, these are sites where people can go and inject under the supervision of a health worker to help prevent overdoses. And Philadelphia officials recently took a trip to Vancouver to check one out. I wonder, especially in your role, if you see this as something the city needs to be seriously considering.
Here in Philadelphia, yeah, we are exploring the idea of safe injection. We particularly are calling them comprehensive user engagement sites. These sites could be places to work with those individuals and work with them around other issues that aren't necessarily their drug addiction. I personally think that this is an initiative that will help save lives. I do hope that is a direction that we're moving in, and hopefully the city will make an overall decision in the next coming months.
Allison Herons, Philadelphia's new harm reduction coordinator, thanks for talking with me.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Allison Herons speaking with WHYY's Alana Gordon. The newest painted mural in Philadelphia is on a bridge spanning over what used to be an encampment of homeless drug users. The B Street Bridge in Kensington over the Conrail train tracks had been the site of a sprawling tent city. WHYY's Peter Crimmins reports that the mural project is backed up by community services.
For decades, the community around the B Street Bridge in Kensington has been predominantly Latino. Local residents wanted Mural Arts Philadelphia to paint the bridge to reflect their heritage. That means bright colors, rosy sunsets, and banana leaves that you might find in the Caribbean. But this neighborhood made national headlines for having an encampment of hundreds of heroin users along the train tracks. Even though the city officially bulldozed that site, artist Calo Rosa says those drug users are still there because they kept coming around to help him paint.
Of course, they are dealing with something, but there's like something positive about, like, I can work on this. I'm working on myself. I put me to do something because I can put my mind away so I can just focus on this and not focus on something else.
A drum line from Kensington School of Creative and Performing Arts played at a dedication ceremony where speakers from City Hall and the neighborhood said this bridge mural is symbolic of new hope for the neighborhood. But it's more than symbolic. Mural Arts Philadelphia opened a storefront nearby that offers social services like housing referrals and recovery programs, as well as art classes. The storefront is part of Mural Arts' Porchlight program, which has a few such spaces around the city, and its director, Lori Byron, said lots of neighborhood artists have been coming to the Kensington space.
Sometimes you have to sort of think about a low barrier for folks getting connected to the arts because they think, like, oh, I can't draw, or oh, I'm not an artist. I find that as soon as we open up the grates at the Kensington storefront, people are just pouring in and saying, I'm an artist, and showing us artwork that they've done on the back of newspapers, on cardboard, in sketchbooks.
Byron says using art to build relationships with people in addiction recovery is an effective way to build trust and maybe get them to enroll in assistance programs they otherwise would avoid. Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller, NewsWorks Tonight.